WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
To the rich man's bright lodges I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp foggy night, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
Muchas gracias, Presidenta.
Thank you. I would like to greet the panel, and on behalf of the Bolivian peoples, I want to say that I am pleased there is such a great gathering to debate global warming and climate change. Today in our discussions, we must be very sincere and very realistic about the problems faced by our peoples, humanity, and the entire planet. I feel that we are not speaking truthfully if we talk about life and the future of humanity while each day we are destroying the future of humanity. It's important to pinpoint who our enemies are, what the causes are of the damage being done to the planet, damage that may put an end to humanity. I'd like to sincerely apologize if some countries or some groups are affected by the survival of my country, the survival of the indigenous people. I think that capitalism is the worst enemy of humanity, and if we do not change the model, change the system, then our presence, our debate, our exchange, and the proposals that we make in these meetings at the United Nations will be totally in vain. Capitalism has twins, the market and war. The market converts life into commodities. It converts land into a commodity. And when capitalists cannot sustain this economic model based on looting, on exploitation, on marginalization, and above all, on the accumulation of capital, they rely on war, the arms race. If we ask ourselves how much money is spent on the arms race, we're never concerned about that. That's why I feel that it is important to change economic models, development models, and economic systems, particularly those in the Western world. And if we do not understand and thoroughly discuss the very survival of our peoples, then we certainly will not be addressing the problem of climate change, the problem of life, the problem for humanity. It is important that we learn lessons from some sectors, from some regions. Let me avail myself of this opportunity. I come from a culture based on peace, from a lifestyle based on equality, of living not only in solidarity with all people, but also living in harmony with Mother Earth. For the indigenous movement, land cannot be a commodity. It is a mother that gives us life. So how could we convert it into a commodity as the Western model does? This is a profound lesson which we must learn in order to resolve the problems of humanity that are being discussed here, climate change and pollution. Where does this pollution come from? It comes from, and is generated by the unsustainable development of a system which destroys the planet, in other words, capitalism. I want to use this opportunity to call on sectors, groups, and nations to abandon luxury, to abandon overconsumption, to think not only about money, but about life. To not only think about accumulating capital, but to think in wider terms about humanity. Only then can we begin to solve the root causes of these problems facing humanity. Because if we don't think that way, if we do not change, it won't matter if business owners have a lot of money. No matter if they are a multinational or even a country, no one can escape these ecological problems, environment problems, and climate change. No one will be spared. And the wealth that some country, some region, or some capitalist may have will be useless. I feel that it is important to organize an international movement to deal with the environment, a movement that will be above institutions, businesses, and countries that just talk about commerce, that only think about accumulating capital. We have to organize a movement that will defend life, defend humanity, and save the earth. I think that it is important to think about some regions, some sectors, and some countries repaying what has often been called the ecological debt. If we do not think about how this ecological debt will be paid, how are we going to solve the problems of life and humanity? I want to say, dear colleagues and friends, that we must assume the responsibility as leaders or as presidents, as governments. We must save life. We must save humanity. We must save the entire planet. Thank you very much. That was a translation of a speech by Bolivian President Evo Morales to the United Nations last September. Morales is Bolivia's first indigenous head of state, and like many other indigenous voices that are finally being heard, he offers a challenge to the conventional belief that a society based on markets and profits is not only superior, but inevitable. This week on the program, we'll hear a variety of perspectives relating to the culture of money and its impacts to complement our ongoing reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. We'll begin with Richard Heinberg, a professor of human ecology at New College in Santa Rosa, who is probably familiar to longtime listeners of this show. He's an internationally known speaker on the subject of peak oil and the energy descent society. Among his books are The Party's Over, Power Down, and his latest, Peak Everything. Here he reads from his monthly publication, The Muse Letter.
And the title of it is Talking Ourselves to Extinction. It has a little introductory paragraph that says, language is a powerful meta-tool that dramatically amplifies cooperative human efforts to control the environment. Language also opens the possibility for religion and science, which otherwise would not exist. Language helped generate our current ecological dilemma. Can language help solve it? So this is the body of the text. In systems theory and evolutionary biology, the word emergence describes the development of complex systems or organs. An emergent phenomenon is one based on the interaction of simpler elements, but whose characteristics cannot be predicted based on a thorough knowledge of those elements. In the course of a species' evolution, a variation may appear that's retained because it confers an advantage in terms of existing functions. But once in place, the new characteristic may act in combination with other capacities of the organism to make truly novel and unexpected functions possible. Life itself has been described as an emergent property of matter, and sensation and mind are emergent properties of higher organisms. Human societies are dynamic, complex systems, and most of their signal features are understandable as emergent phenomena. It's a fascinating thought exercise that I've been at for more than two decades now to attempt to trace series of events in the past in order to identify the most decisive developments that enabled the emergence of industrial civilization. Of course, societal complexity depends on our human ability to capture increasing amounts of energy from our environment. And so our genetic and social attributes that facilitate energy capture are crucial. Which of those attributes are keys to understanding the entire process? Clearly, most of the emergent features of complex societies, their economies, technologies, and governments, depend on language. Now, language itself is an emergent phenomenon, a link in a long chain of them. However, it was a profoundly consequential one. In the grand edifice of human society, it should be considered a foundation stone. The questions of how and when language evolved are hotly debated. Some archaeologists argue that the relatively sudden appearance, roughly 40,000 years ago, of counting sticks and new kinds of hunting tools suggests that language arose then. However, humans, including Neanderthals, were anatomically capable of speech much earlier. Indeed, there's fossil evidence that the main areas of the brain associated with language, Broca's area and Wernicke's area, started to enlarge up to 1.5 million years ago. Moreover, humans' ability to spread to regions outside of Africa, and especially to islands, may have depended upon their use of language to convey information and intention and to coordinate tasks. It may be that we've been using language so long that our brains, throats, and chests have all evolved in tandem. The situation is likely similar to what has happened in the computer industry over the past few decades. Just as hardware and software developers work cooperatively, one designing according to the needs and capacities of the other, our own internal hardware, our brain and speech faculties, and our software, our language, have become, in a sense, made for one another. Part of the problem in determining when and how language arose may lie in definitions. The term language can refer in a vague or general sense to any sort of communication, but this usage is not always helpful. All animals communicate using sound, color, scent, or gesture. Even plants and fungi communicate with one another using chemicals and gene packets transmitted via soil or air. Human language differs from these kinds of information transfer in its level of abstraction, its multiplicity of symbols, and in the complexity of its grammar or system of rules for the manipulation of symbols. It's one thing to signal a somatic or emotional state or a general intention, but quite another to discuss events, including hypothetical ones, in the future or the past or in distant places. Language made these things possible, but much more as well. Language generated our peculiarly human form of self-awareness. We can talk about ourselves, talk about talking, and think about thinking. Our relationship with our environment also changed as language enabled us to coordinate our thinking and behavior across time and distance in a way that was unprecedented, making us a far more formidable species. Compare the population size and environmental impacts of humans today with those of chimpanzees or gorillas. Writing only exacerbated these trends, heightening the level of abstraction in language and widening our ability to convey thoughts and align collective action. If talking helped organize effective hunting bands, writing enabled the formation of nation-states. Add printing, radio, television, and fossil fuels, and here we are today. But with language came an array of unintended consequences, which, of course, is just another name for emergent phenomena. New section, Language and Religion. In the beginning was the Word, begins the Gospel according to John. In Genesis, creation commences with a series of spoken commands, starting with, let there be light. The creation stories of the ancient Egyptians, Celts, and Mayans likewise emphasized the generative potency of language. This striking coincidence, noted by many scholars of world mythology, cloaks a supreme irony. While religion ascribes magical power to words, there are reasons to think that religion itself may be an inevitable, though accidental, outgrowth of language. It's interesting to speculate as to whether non-human animals have awareness of something that we humans might consider a spiritual dimension of existence. Do dogs and cats have near-death or out-of-body experiences? Do birds experience awe and wonder when watching the sunrise? Well, there's no way to know for sure. In any case, it's fairly clear that no non-human species has developed a religion, if we mean by this term an organized set of beliefs about the supernatural and a set of practices oriented to the service or worship of a divine being or beings. Well, why not? What's unique about humans that would lead us to construct religions? Are we set apart because we alone possess immortal souls? Or do our brains contain some unusual structure shared by no other animal? Well, research into neurotheology, while controversial, offers some clues. Religious or spiritual experiences seem primarily to be associated with the right temporal lobe of the neocortex, implying that feelings associated with such experiences are normal features of brain function under extreme circumstances. Nevertheless, it's likely that the problem of religion is as much an issue of software, that is, language, as it is one of hardware or brain structure. Let's suppose that language was initially used only for practical purposes, such as coordinating hunting efforts. Slowly, haphazardly, people must have developed rudimentary elements of vocabulary and grammar, often in order to aid with planning, an activity inherently implying the senses of location, time, cause, effect, and intention. Women, men, and children began to make simple sentences to ask and to explain who, what, where, when, and why. Once the abilities to pose and answer such questions were in place, these inevitably began to be applied to less immediately pressing concerns. The Pleistocene hunter went from asking, "Where did these bison come from?" to, "Where did the stars, the moon, the sun, and people come from?" Hence, the mythologies of Aboriginal peoples everywhere are rich in origin stories. Language was seductive in its power. Once a tiny morsel of reality had been verbally nibbled off, its incomplete digestion provoked a recurring hunger to take another and yet another bite, and eventually to swallow the world whole. As power over the environment grew, as society became more complex and formidable, religion mutated accordingly. Hunter-gatherers saw nature as alive and filled with spiritual presences that could directly be engaged by way of shamanic practices. Such beliefs and behaviors grew out of these people's direct interaction with their environment and fit their needs for social cohesion within an egalitarian context. With division of labor and thus a hierarchical organization of society came full-time specialists who got their food not directly from nature but from other humans. Some of these specialists were spiritual intermediaries or priests who appealed to sky gods detached from nature and the lives of commoners. With writing, myths about the gods could be codified and carried to distant lands. These side effects of language have had their own perplexing and sometimes nasty consequences. With religion, we have come to believe absurdities, and hallucinated gods and demons have become central to people's lives. Here in America, in the early 21st century, it's considered normal for people to talk regularly with a shared imaginary friend. and to believe that this particular imaginary friend is uniquely efficacious. To believe, in fact, that to talk to any other imaginary friend would be blasphemy. While this behavior appears more than a tad daft to non-participants, the latter rarely comment on it publicly because to do so would be impolite, and because the believers are so numerous and so vehement in the defense and promotion of their practices. Now, talking to imaginary friends may actually serve a useful purpose. Back in the early 1980s, Julian Jaynes theorized that conversing with hallucinated gods provides a way for otherwise walled-off verbal and nonverbal areas of the brain to interact with one another. Nevertheless, the practice clearly risks personal and societal disengagement from reality. Many people have been killed simply because they talked to the wrong imaginary friend or refused to talk to the right one. German Orientalist Max Müller, who virtually created the discipline of comparative religion, put the matter succinctly by asserting that mythology is, quote, a disease of language. Perhaps the word disease seems too harsh. After all, mythology has its uses as well. As Joseph Campbell never tired of saying, myth gives us meaning. And surely meaning is a good thing. Nevertheless, the human need for meaning again highlights our obsessive and dependent relationship with language. Meaning is always attached to symbols. We invest a symbol with meaning, and that meaning is conveyed to whoever correctly interprets the symbol. We see a sentence written in an unfamiliar language, and we wonder, what does it mean? As we've become ever more hooked on linguistic symbols, we have come to see nearly everything as if it were a sign for something else. We look to stars, tea leaves, and coincidences for meaning. The universe is talking to us. Myths are verbal narratives that seek to unpack the meaning of existence. We seldom wonder why it is that life itself must have meaning in order for it to be satisfying. Is it possible that existence could be sufficient unto itself with no need for an embedded message? Religion consists of more than just mythology, though. Surely religion evolved at least partly to coordinate and moderate collective behavior via systems of morality and ethics. The senses of good and evil, of honor and shame, have become such powerful internal motivators for humans that even most atheists are continually compelled by them. There's nothing quite like this among other species, whose behavior tends to be less learned and more genetically scripted, and who therefore do not engage in the practices of rewarding or punishing one another's behavior nearly to the same degree we do. Ironically, morality often contributes to humans' most brutal acts, which have little precedent in other animals. Witch burnings, as just one example, were morally motivated. Nevertheless, the development of complex societies would surely have been difficult, if not impossible, without morality, which had previously often been turned toward ecological ends, as early societies codified their needs to moderate reproduction, avoid incest, and protect natural resources via their taboos. For example, do not kill the red kangaroo during its mating season. But then, once religion and society had mutually mutated in the direction of abstraction and complexity, morality became at least partly unhinged from environmental and genetic necessity and began increasingly to adhere to written myths about the verbally hallucinated sky gods. From an ecological point of view, the results were sometimes inadvertently salutary. Religious wars, such as the Crusades, helped temporarily to moderate human population levels, though comparable results had been achieved by some hunter-gatherer societies using gentler methods such as herbal contraception. Some religions also promoted celibacy among priests, monks, and nuns, again helping to stem population growth. But as people's verbal obsessions began to be taken up with myths that had more to do with consolidating the power of religious elites than with regulating people's relations with the natural world, religion served increasingly as an instrument of social and ecological conquest. Nevertheless, if language muddied humans' connections with nature by way of verbal speculation, regimentation, and hallucination, it also fostered a countervailing tendency. New section. Grammar, reason, logic, and evidence. Other animals observe, plan, draw conclusions from experience, and continually revise their mental pictures of reality. These capacities, the foundations of reason, are not uniquely human. Logic is inherent in grammar, which people developed and used long before there were grammar schools or schools of any sort, and young children still absorb the basic rules of grammar intuitively without having to be drilled in them. In language, each coherent packet of meaning, such as a sentence, must adhere to some agreed-upon standards if it's useful. In this regard, a sentence is like a mathematical equation. Mathematics, after all, is itself a language. Before an equation can be correct or incorrect, it must conform to basic rules. Unlike the statements 2 plus 6 equals 8 and 3 plus 4 equals 9, one of which we would recognize as being true, the other false, the statement equals 5 plus 7 minus cannot be said to be true or false. It's simply unintelligible because it's not organized as a complete equation according to the basic rules of arithmetic. Quantum physicist Wolfgang Pauli, who was known for his abhorrence of sloppy thinking, once famously commented that another scientist's work was, quote, not even wrong. Grammar and logic give us the basis for making comprehensible statements about the world. Linking logic with empirical evidence helps us formulate true statements and recognize when statements are false. This, again, is a long-standing practice. Millennia before the scientific method was codified, people relied on feedback between language and sensory data to develop an accurate understanding of the world. Are the salmon running yet? Let's go look. However, not all possible statements could be checked empirically. If someone said, "These berries taste good," well, that was at least a matter for investigation, even if everyone didn't agree. But the situation was more complicated if someone said, "The volcano smokes." That must be because the gods are angry. And if the gods are angry, it must be because we haven't provided enough sacrifices. Unlike the observation that the volcano was smoking, the following two statements and the reasoning behind them had no checkable basis. Unless, of course, the gods could be called into the village commons and publicly queried about their moods and motives. And the attempt to do so may actually have led to the origin of shamanic transmediumship. In any case, this was magical thinking, reasoning based on mere correlation rather than an empirically, publicly verifiable chain of causation. It was inevitable that magical thinking would flourish given that there were so many subjects of interest for which empirical investigation was impractical or even irrelevant. That situation continues today. There's no practical, empirical basis for answering once and for all and to everyone's satisfaction questions like, does God exist? Who am I? What happens to us when we die? Or what is the greatest good? Yet, however strong the temptation to engage in it, magical thinking, when tied to religion, failed to provide much practical help in industry or commerce. As these limits came to be appreciated and as industry and commerce expanded, philosophers and students of nature began to construct the formalized system of inquiry known as the scientific method. Here was a way to obtain verifiable knowledge of the physical world. Better still, it was knowledge that could often be put to practical effect. The method came to hand at a propitious time. Wealth was flowing to Europe from the rest of the world due to colonization and slavery. Meanwhile, the development of metallurgy and simple heat engines had proceeded to the point where the energy of fossil fuels could be put to widespread use. When coupled with the project of technological invention, science and mathematics yielded undreamt of power over the environment. When further coupled with capitalism, corporations, banking, and investment, and fossil fuels, the result was the industrial growth machine. Well, all of this would have been fine if we lived in an infinite sea of resources. But instead, we inhabit a bounded, finite planet. Humanity had set course toward disaster. So this is a new section called Language and the Ecological Dilemma. The ecological dilemma, which consists of the mutually rebounding impacts of population pressure, resource depletion, and habitat destruction, is certainly not unique to the modern industrial era. Indeed, it's not unique even to humans. However, modern humans have created a dilemma for themselves of unprecedented scope and scale. The dilemma, whether encountered by people or pigeons, is often a matter of the failure of success. The genetically ingrained aims of the organism are to reproduce and to increase its energy capture, but its environment always has limited resources. Thus, temporary population blooms, which are in their way evidence of biological success, are usually followed by a crash and die-off. In humans, the powers conferred by language, tools, and social organization have enabled many boom and bust cycles over the millennia. But the recent fossil fuel era has seen so much growth of population and consumption that there's an overwhelming likelihood of a crash of titanic proportions. This should be obvious to everyone. We know about the ecological dilemma from our ecologists' studies of population blooms and crashes in other species. Our soil scientists appreciate the limits of modern agriculture. Our geologists understand perfectly well that fossil fuels are finite in quantity. And our mathematicians can easily calculate exponential growth rates to show how quickly population increase and resource depletion will outstrip our ability to satisfy even the most basic human needs. Verbal and mathematical logic, joined with empirical evidence, make an airtight case. We're headed toward a cliff. But language also keeps most of us in the dark. This is partly because magical thinking is alive and well, and not just in churches and New Age seminars. In the last couple of centuries, the magical thinking associated with religion, under assault from science, has found a new home in political and economic ideologies. Economics, which masquerades as a science, began as a branch of moral philosophy, which it still is, in fact. For free market ideologues, the market is God, and profit is the ultimate good. We've used language to talk ourselves into the myth of progress, the belief that growth is always beneficial and that there are no practical limits to the size of the human population or to the usable extent of renewable or even non-renewable natural resources. This particular myth was an easy sell. It's an inherently welcome message, a version of you can eat your cake and have it too. And it seemed to be confirmed by experience during a multi-generational period of unprecedented expansion based on the one-time-only consumption of Earth's hydrocarbon stores. Meanwhile, at the business end of economic theory, masters of advertising, marketing, and public relations have learned deftly to manipulate symbols and images for emotional effect, sculpting the public's aspirations for comfort and prestige. This new kind of magical thinking does contribute to commerce and industry, and spectacularly so. Meanwhile, in politics, the 20th century saw battles between the quasi-religious ideologies of the left and the right. Leninism, Stalinism, fascism, Nazism, and Maoism, along with British it's-for-your-own-good colonialism and equally benevolent Yankee imperialism. In recent years, the political philosophy of Leo Strauss and his followers has come to the fore via the neoconservative members of the current Bush administration. Strauss taught a doctrine that's really just the explicit utterance of an implicit belief common among ruling elites, that it's the duty of wise leaders to cloak their policies in potent, patriotic, and religious symbols and myths in order to galvanize the internal ethical imperatives of the masses. In other words, lies, if told by the right people for the right reasons, are not only good and necessary, they're the very foundation of responsible statecraft. On this basis, however, language ceases to provide a tool set for accurately mapping the world, and instead becomes a mental haze enveloping society, preventing us from collectively grasping our situation. Only the rulers are expected, or allowed, to know the true score. But all too often, they come to believe their own myths. And so we today live in a fog of words, so thick that it largely prevents us from seeing where we are or where we're headed. Language helps us understand, and at the same time prevents understanding. It enables reason and rationality, yet also facilitates their very opposites. Simply put, language magnifies all of the conflicting priorities and potentials of the human organism. So this is the last section. Can language help us now? It might seem that the solution to our quandary is a big dose of logic and empiricism. Well, if only the matter were that simple. Modern brain research explodes the notion that logic can exist in pristine isolation from emotion and somatic states. As neurologist Antonio Damasio explained in his book, Descartes' Error, Emotion, Reason, and the Human Brain, emotion and reason are not separate. In fact, the latter is inherently dependent upon the former. Damasio explored the unusual case of Phineas Gage, a man whose severe brain injury prevented him from feeling emotions. While Gage remained intelligent and responsive after his accident, he lost the ability to make rational decisions and to reason because his emotions were inaccessible to the process. Damasio argued that bodily sensations give rise to emotions, which in turn provide the basis for rational thought, as well as irrational thought. Thus, our state of mind merely reflects our state of body, with emotion as the essential intermediary. The rational and emotional functions of language appear to be handled differently by the hemispheres of the brain. It seems that the left hemisphere processes verbiage that conveys linguistic meaning, while the right hemisphere processes verbal, as well as musical and other artistic expression, that conveys emotional content. There are indications that in most people, the right hemisphere has a tendency to repress the free functioning of the left, thus making brain activity lopsided and dysfunctional, while fomenting self-sabotaging internal conflict. This may be one reason that we can appear perfectly rational in our pursuit of ends that are, from another perspective, just plain crazy. Again, the organism wants energy, space, and the opportunity to reproduce itself. However, if every human's individual pursuit of these goals went unchecked, there would be no organized society because all collective effort would dissolve in a continual one-on-one competition. Humans would go from bloom to crash with no period of stability between, and none of this would serve the organism's long-term interests. Therefore, the organism also needs to cooperate, to attenuate wants and desires, and to restrain reproduction. Accordingly, we've developed innumerable customs, institutions, and moral strictures to promote moderation. The result is the battle of instinct against society that Freud agonized over and largely mischaracterized in his book, Civilization and Its Discontents. In stable societies, a truce is struck that may last centuries or millennia. In our modern world, temporary success based on unique historical circumstances has led us to cast most self-limitation aside, and we've given ourselves perfectly good reasons for doing so. The truce is broken, and we are at war with nature and with future generations. Is it possible now and quickly to tame the organism's hunger for growth and to head off catastrophe? Yes, in principle. One of the wonders of language is that it makes rapid societal change possible. Where another species would require centuries or millennia of genetic variation and natural selection to adapt itself to new conditions, we can shift our collective behavior in a matter of months or years, given language, media, and collective appeals to ethics. Whether it's possible to do so in the current situation, given the enormous growth momentum developed during the past two centuries, remains to be seen. Nevertheless, it is a useful exercise to imagine how a rapid surge toward collective self-limitation might come about. Somehow, leaders would have to engage the non-rational aspects of mass consciousness by playing upon our shared needs for meaning and myth, using verbal voodoo to alter attitudes and behavior as rapidly as possible. Wartime jingoism has accomplished something similar on many occasions in the past. An appeal would need to be made on an ethical basis to reduce consumption and alter personal aspirations. President Carter tried to do this when he suggested back in 1977 that solving the energy crisis was, in his words, the moral equivalent of war. But sadly, other politicians and the arbiters of economy and culture failed to back him up. To be successful, such an effort would require the enthusiastic participation of the advertising, public relations, and entertainment industries, as well as organized religions and all major political institutions. The campaign would have little chance of success if it were not also based on sound, rational arguments, since purely emotional appeals would be rejected out of hand by the most intelligent and influential members of society. Moreover, if an attempt to change collective behavior were not based on empirically verifiable, survival-based necessity, it would amount to crass manipulation worthy of a Karl Rove or an Edward Bernays. Hence, its moral credibility would soon wane. In the current instance, the rational basis for the appeal and its survival necessity are clear. Nothing is to be lost and everything is to be gained by sharing accurate and relevant information about our situation. There's no need to exaggerate the threat. Today, precisely such an effort is already underway with regard to climate change. Al Gore and his famous movie have framed the crisis in moral terms. While hundreds of scientists, by endorsing the conclusions of the IPCC, have established a concurrent appeal to rationality. As yet, the message does not have a sufficiently broad base of cultural support to curtail the ongoing, richly funded calls to buy, consume, and travel. Perhaps the addition of the peak oil message by highlighting immediate economic and geopolitical threats posed by continued societal reliance on fossil fuels will help broaden the coalition of support for needed change. But all of this will have to happen very quickly. At this point, language is a given. For better or worse, we humans are stuck with it, even if it arguably has contributed to crises that threaten us with extinction. One way or another, the way we deal with the enormous ecological challenge facing us will be mediated by words, words, and more words, some accurately reflecting the situation, others concealing it. Meanwhile, here we are, I reading, you listening. We share, I hope and assume, a commitment to logic and evidence and to an ethic of collective human and non-human survival that transcends the myths of religion and progress. There's no denying the satisfaction, even thrill, that comes when language hits its mark by dramatically aiding our understanding of what is by now an unimaginably complex human matrix. Perhaps the most we can do now as before, though with more urgency than ever, is to harness that thrill by using language skillfully to describe and persuade, and meanwhile to act in ways that are congruent with the ethical content of our words.
Richard Heinberg, author and peak oil educator, reading from his Muse letter. You can find out more about his work at richardheinberg.com. Heinberg is spelled H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. You may have heard recent news coverage about an organization in Indiana, Liberty Dollars, that was raided by federal agents who confiscated all their products, records, and bank accounts. They were minting Liberty Dollars, coins of gold, silver, and copper, and also paper scrip backed by gold and silver held in a vault. They had 20 million Liberty Dollars in circulation. Their goal was to give people an alternative medium of exchange to the official currency, one that would hold its value because of its metal content and backing, rather than lose value through inflation as the U.S. dollar has been doing. Many people may not be aware of the decline in the value of the dollar in relation to other currencies and commodities, but everyone has noticed its effects, sharply rising prices in just about every necessity. The government is asserting that Liberty Dollars created confusion in the public mind in that they might be mistaken for government-issued legal tender. This claim by the government is not convincing, and the widespread consensus by commentators as well as the Liberty Dollar organization is that the success and sophistication of the effort was considered a threat to the status quo. A few weeks ago, I played a radio adaptation of an animated film by Paul Grignon called Money is Debt that explains how money is created out of thin air by banks through the issuance of loans. There are a variety of ramifications to this, but one important one is that the banks decide who gets money and for what purpose. Since the loans must be paid back with interest, the banks only lend money for activities that will generate profits or create collateral that is commercially valuable. Therefore, one can have a bank create money to bulldoze a beautiful forest and put up an ugly strip mall. But a bank will not create money for someone who wants to bulldoze a strip mall and plant a forest. Unless, of course, the forest is to be later cut down and sold as lumber or made into a forest theme park. The idea that people can just be happy living in the presence of a forest is without value under capitalism, unless those people can be made to pay dearly for the privilege of living where there is beauty, which is why toxic waste dumps are not built next to mansions. This is an example of what Evo Morales was talking about when he called capitalism the enemy of efforts to deal with the destruction of our environment. Many people wax eloquent about the Constitution, including on this program, but my view is that it leaves a lot to be desired. It does not protect our most basic human rights, including our birthright to live among trees and birds, sparkling clean waterways, and fresh air. Those rights should be guaranteed to all, not just to those who can pay a high price for them. Richard Heinberg has spoken of a post-peak oil world where meeting one's needs locally will become a matter of life and death. But a movement to rebuild local economies is already underway as a reaction to the increasing control of people's lives and livelihoods by large corporations. Local money systems, such as our own Ithaca Hours, are part of an uphill battle to recapture some economic control. Local money systems have a long history in America and have helped communities in the past survive depressions because they could control money creation when the banks failed. Since most people, it seems, can't imagine we could actually live in a world where things aren't bought and sold, we'll turn our attention next to an idea for monetary reform. In this case, a system for local credit creation that is meant to, as our next speaker, Tom Greco, says, build a credit commons. As with many things dealing with finance, you may want to listen to it more than once to absorb the concept and details. Tom Greco is a community and monetary economist and former college professor. He's currently director of the nonprofit Community Information Resource Center, which provides information and administrative support for efforts in community improvement, social justice, and sustainability. He's regarded as one of the leading experts in monetary theory and history, credit clearing systems, complementary currencies, and community economic development. He's the author of 3 books on the subject. His latest book on complementary currencies and exchange systems, titled Money, Understanding and Creating Alternatives to Legal Tender, was published in 2001. He spoke last spring in Sebastopol, California.
Thank you, thank you. Thanks for that warm welcome. Well, I'm really glad to be back in Sebastopol. I've been here a few times before. And Phil and I and Art and Ed and a number of other people have been working on this project for a long time. And I'm happy to be able to provide whatever assistance I can in seeing this project through. We thought it would be launched by now, but things take whatever time they take. The biggest problem, I think, in developing a community exchange system is in developing, first of all, the best architecture for the system that's possible. And we don't have a lot of good models. You know, we're at the stage of development with alternative exchange that aviation was at more than 100 years ago. So you've seen all the pictures of the umbrellas bouncing up and down, people flapping their wings and jumping off roofs, trying to fly. And so we've had a lot of false starts and experiments that didn't work out too well, but there are some promising things as well. And we have a lot of good information from the past. I've benefited from the research that I've done in discovering some really insightful people from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, people who really understood money. And I think if we're going to come to some really effective alternative exchange systems, we're going to have to take a scientific approach to it. Flying by the seat of the pants will only get you so far. What made the Wright brothers so successful in their attempts to achieve manned-powered flight was the fact that they did take a scientific approach, and they did a lot of experimentation. They learned what they could from people who had gone before, and they designed the first wind tunnels, and they did a lot of accurate measurements from their experiments. And there were three basic problems they had. One was lift. How do you get lift with a craft that's heavier than air? Another one was propulsion. How do you get the thing to move? And the third one was control. How do you control it once you get it up there so you don't crash? So we have a similar situation with the alternative exchange movement. We've got to find the answers that are analogous to those three factors. Well, let me start with a PowerPoint slideshow that I think will be useful. So Phil was talking about localization, and I was mentioning to some people earlier tonight that I recently viewed Michael Schumann's lecture on going local, and it was a very well-prepared and very insightful presentation. He mentioned local currencies in that, but of course didn't go into any great detail. The importance of a local exchange system, and we sometimes talk about currencies, but it's not only currency. Actually, currency is a word that has a lot of different meanings. You can develop a local currency, or you can develop a mutual credit clearing system. And I'm going to talk mostly about the latter in tonight's presentation. Basically, the fact is this. Money is credit. If there's one big secret about money, that's it. Money is credit. Now, we have all this folklore about gold and silver and redeemability and reserves and all of that stuff. Forget it. Money today is credit. That's all it is. And credit is the lifeblood of business. But there are two distinct credit functions that often get mixed up. You have the exchange function. This is short-term credit or working capital. It's also been called turnover credit. Turnover credit is credit that represents goods that are in the market ready to be sold. So you can think of money as short-term credit. Money is a virtual representation of value that's in the market ready to be sold. So in managing a money system, you want to create money as goods and services go into the market. You don't want to create money that doesn't have attendant goods and services going to market. This is often confused with the finance function. People often ask, what about savings? What about if you want to save something up for a big purchase? Or what if you want to finance the creation of a new business? Well, that's the finance function. The finance function involves long-term investment. And savings and investment are two sides of the same coin. If I have surplus money in today's system, what do I do with it? I don't leave it in my checking account. I invest it. If I want to save, I put it into a different medium. So I'm going to be strict in applying these terminologies. Money is short-term credit. If you want savings and investment, that's long-term credit. So credit comes from the word credo, which means belief. And so the question is, what do we believe? What's credit based on? It's based on trust. So who do you trust? Who are you willing to trust? Are you yourself trustworthy? It's all promises. Every piece of currency, every demand deposit, every savings deposit, every CD, every stock, every bond is a claim. That's all it is. It's a claim. It's a legal claim against something. So it's all based on promises. Now, some of these promises are more secure than others. Some have very strict legal contracts attending them. Others have collateral assets that can be foreclosed and liquidated in case of default.